And then the next day he said, come take a walk with me around the outfield. And he said, we clocked you at 93 in the first three innings, and then you dipped down into the high 80s, and then you went back up to the low 90s, and then you went down to 87. He said, son, do me a favor, have a clubhouse meeting with yourself and decide what you want to be.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to former Braves and Yankees farmhand Scott Patterson, who is known less for his baseball career and more known for his 30 years and counting career as an actor. He's had cameo roles in shows like Seinfeld and Will and Grace. He's played the disgruntled pitcher McGreevy in one of my favorite baseball movies, Little Big League, but is best known as Luke Danes on the show Gilmore Girls. Quick backstory. Growing up as a Twins fan, Little Big League is one of my favorite baseball movies. Watching it as an adult, I noticed that Patterson really looked like he knew what he was doing on the mound. It turns out that's for good reason, as he had a seven-year pro career. And what a career it was. Scott is, I think, the first three-time draftee we've had on the show, being drafted three times in a 12-month span, which is especially impressive for a guy who gave up baseball in high school. We talk about his minor league days in the 1980s, back when starters would throw 10 innings, coming up with a plethora of talent in the Braves system, being mentored by past legends like Johnny Sain and future legends like Leo Mazzoni, and his eventual trade to the discombobulated Yankees of the 1980s, playing with guys like Don Mattingly, facing guys like Andre Dawson, and scratching and clawing his way up to AAA waiting for a call that never came. Also, some good Little Big League talk on the back end of this one. No Gilmore Girls talk, there was just too much good baseball. Scott was an incredible resource and very generous with his time. I'm thrilled that he stopped by the show. Episodes from Phenom to the Farm drop every month. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. Spring training is about to kick off. We've got 2026 draft content. We've got college baseball season kicking off. As always, it is a great time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Scott Patterson. All right, joining in for today's episode of Phenom on the Farm, he was a supplemental first-round choice by the Braves in the January 1980 draft, pitched seven seasons in the minors. Many people know him from Gilmore Girls. Cool people know him from Little Big League. It's former Braves and Yankees farmhand Scott Patterson. Scott, thank you so much for joining the show.
Kyle, thanks for having me on. Good to see you.
Of course. As I am leading the charge in trying to revitalize Little Big League in terms of like people giving it the respect it's due. I am a Minnesota Twins fan, so it's close and near and dear to my heart. But there was one day I was watching Little Big League and I was like, man, McGreevy looks like he's throwing fuzz. And I did a little, you know, did a little diving and here we are. But I wanted to start with, I am a 2 to 5 cup of coffee a day guy, just depending on how the day is going. I tell me about Scotty P's Big Mug Coffee, and then what is the perfect cup of coffee? How do you make the perfect cup of coffee?
Well, the easy answer I'll hand it first is I like it black with a dab of high quality honey. And I like a medium blend sometimes, and I like a darker roast at other times. But you know, that company came about, a couple decades ago, and I couldn't get it off the ground. And I kept trying to make a deal with Warner Brothers, who wasn't really interested, because as they said to me repeatedly from 2002 onward, was we don't do consumer products very well, especially if they're, you know, food items. So I decided in 2016 to branch out on my own and start my own brand. And it's pretty much an homage to my mother, who guided me through some very turbulent teenage years over cups of freeze-dried coffee in our little kitchen at our little kitchen table. So, it was also because I wanted to own a business and have equity in the business and be responsible for it instead of, you know, being an employee in a linear experience. If you will, I wanted it to go exponential potentially. So, those are basically the reasons that I started the company.
Well, we will. We'll make sure the link will be in the show notes for anyone who wants to grab a bag of Scotty P's Big Mug coffee. But I want to go back to your playing days. I want to go back to the late '70s. How do you go from a guy who quits baseball in high school, hangs it up? How do you go from then enrolling at Rutgers to pitching at Valencia College? Can you walk me through that timeline?
So I'm at Rutgers first semester. I'm living off campus with, and one of the people that was in the house that I was living in was a PhD candidate in history, American history. His name was Todd. And we were throwing the football around one day, in front of the house in the street. And he kind of stopped and said, "Okay, what's happening with your arm? Like, what is going on here?" Because my hands hurt. And, you know, you're throwing 50-yard seeds at me on a line. And I said, "Well, I have a background," or whatever. And I told him, and I kind of told him the story, you know, the sad high school tale of why I left baseball. He goes, and he was the first one to put it in my brain to, he said, "My God, don't waste that talent, you know, go after it." And so I contacted an old Legion coach, American Legion coach. I was I was selected to be on a team called Brooklawn, which was the kind of an all-star team for South Jersey, as a freshman in high school. So I played 2 years on that summer league team, and we traveled a great deal. And I think Brooklawn's gone on to be national champions a couple of times. And it was always a very prestigious thing to be a part of. Anyway, Harry Maurice was a baseball coach at Middle Tennessee State. And then he was at Brooklawn as an assistant coach. And I contacted him and I said, "I want to get back into it. Can you get me in shape?" And he said, "Yeah," he got me in shape. He called the scouting bureau, you know, 25 scouts showed up. I did a workout for them with some other local kids. And I got offered a bunch of contracts, but they weren't very attractive offers. Harry had his former Middle Tennessee guy manager, Floyd Perry, there, who was now Valencia head coach. And Floyd said, "We'd love to have you down in Orlando." So that's what I did. I went down to Orlando. I pitched a bunch of games. I got a bunch of scholarship offers for some pretty prestigious colleges programs. I got drafted number 4 in the January draft by the Toronto Blue Jays. That was an indication that I'd made a good decision for once in the last couple of years. I turned down the Blue Jays, which was really not a good decision. That was a bad decision.
I was going to add, you're one of the few 3-time draftees we've had on the show. January 79.
Yeah,
June 79, and then January 80. Yep. What were the factors? And then also moving, if I have it correctly, going from Valencia to Mesa, and then to Long Beach.
Okay,
very interesting. You know, okay, what a year.
The Mesa move was at Valencia. Floyd Perry wanted to market me. And the local press was catching on and all this stuff. And they were writing pieces about me. And Floyd was saying, you know, he's as good as I've ever had here and blah, blah, blah. Right. So he was just being very, very supportive of me. And the winter meetings were in Orlando that year. So he invited everybody to this sort of all-star game that he created so that all of those baseball general managers and scouts and whomever who were ever at the baseball winter meetings would come and watch the game. And I pitched in that game, and Rod Dedeaux was there from USC. And I wanted to be a part of USC's baseball team for a while. So the thought was go from Valencia or get an AA degree, 'cause I had to get an AA degree to be eligible to transfer to a Division I school, NCAA Division I school. So I met Rod Dedeaux. I said, "I want to be a Trojan." And he said, "Son, if you want to be a Trojan, you already are one. And he said, we'd love to have you. So I went to Long Beach because Dato gave me a job at his trucking company, Dato Auto and Repair. So I went to Long Beach. I was not a member of the Long Beach City College team. I was just there to be near USC, to work out and to get in shape and to stay in shape with Long Beach City College, who were not too thrilled about the idea, by the way, and have a job and make some money and get my A degree and then transfer to USC on scholarship. Didn't work out that way. Got drafted. Well, I'm sorry. No, I skipped Mesa. I went to Mesa.
Mesa would have been January, like spring season 79.
Yeah, no. Mesa was after the Blue Jays, right? Mm-hmm. Mesa was a Rod Dato kind of a path for me.
Because Mesa's got that pipeline that, like, it packed.
It does.
The Pac-12, Mesa being right next to ASU, has that.
ASU, has that Jim pipeline. Brock, the whole mm-hmm. thing. And so I contacted the guy at Scottsdale Junior College, Jim Fry at Mesa, a couple other people. And I said, hi, I'm the number 4 draft pick in the January draft. Would you like me on your team?
Good resume.
And they'd say, sure. But my conversation with Fry convinced me that'd be the place to go. So I went there. I went a semester. I got in better pitching shape, you know, and then I went to the next year. I went to, because I only had 1 year under my belt. I needed another year. So I wanted to be closer to LA and Dato and the program. So that's why I went to Long Beach City College. In the interim, Toronto sent Bobby Maddock out, who was he was a scout at that time before he became GM, or before he became the manager of the team. And before he became GM, he was scout, and they sent him out to Arizona with orders to sign me or not come home. Toronto was very high on me. And I think Toronto would have gotten me to the big leagues very quickly, probably before I was ready. And I just said, no, we were $20,000 apart, you know? And they just said, we can't give you any more money, but we'll bring you to big league camp. How's that? And I just said, no, I want to be valued at a certain level that I feel is fair. And it just didn't work out. And I pitched against Toronto or A ball, double A, triple A, and always did well against them. But yeah, I think that was a big mistake not signing with them. Your first offer is usually your best, you know.
What so you get the A's pop you that June, no deal
A's,
there.
There's another organization I probably should have signed with, but they offered so little money, I had so little value to them.
That hasn't changed. A's offering so little money, that seems to be a running theme.
Yeah, that wasn't going to work out. Yeah, I played in Alaska too in the summer league in the Alaska League during that time. And gained even more experience against the best hitters in the country, best college hitters in the country. Really helpful experience. And then Atlanta came in and drafted me, and I would, you know, I had really no choice but to sign. So I signed with Atlanta.
Was it the financials of that decision? Because I mean, if you have USC waiting in the fall, or was it just, hey, third time's the charm, you know, I got to take this opportunity while I know I have it?
No, I wanted to go pro. I just, you know, I was 20 and I was like, you know, I'm kind of ready. And so I just signed with the Braves. Yeah, it was a great opportunity. And that was a good decision because right away, you know, you're exposed to Johnny Sain, you know, and being exposed to Marcel Lachman at USC would have been great too, right? I would have learned a lot. But here I am in the pros and I'm around people like Sonny Jackson and Brian Snitker was our third base coach. And in that 1980 in Anderson, I believe he was the third base coach. I think it was Sonny Jackson was the manager. And then the next year in Durham, I'm with Bob Veal, pitching coach. I mean, and then when I went to Double A that year, Leo Mazzoni. I mean, it just it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah. Well, you drafted in January of 80. Mm-hmm. I mean, now with there only being the June draft, typically the first professional season for most guys is, you know, 9 months after they get drafted. You know, some guys get a cup of coffee in the minors or whatever, just depending on where they're drafted. But you're drafted in 80. Presumably you're off to spring training within a month. After. And then you're in low A Anderson. How long is the learning curve to becoming a professional, learning routines, you know, the 5-day rotation, like how to go about your business? Like how long did you say it took to be comfortable in, I have a routine, I'm a professional, I know how to do this?
It took me that whole first season. Because Paul Snyder, who was, I guess at that time, the director of player development, came down from Atlanta to watch the Anderson team. And he watched me pitch. And then the next day he said, come take a walk with me around the outfield. And he said, we clocked you at 93 in the first three innings. And then you dipped down into the high 80s. And then you went back up to the low 90s. And then you went down to 87. He said, son, do me a favor, have a clubhouse meeting with yourself and decide what you want to be. And that's all he said. So he was telling me to be a professional, to be more consistent, to work harder on my conditioning, to stop with this sort of roller coaster velocity that I'm not in command of. And just know myself better as a pitcher. And I took it to heart. I made the All-Star team. Halfway through, I pitched a couple of great games against the Yankee minor league Greenville Hornets. Faced Don Mattingly like, I don't know, 12 times that season with middling success. You know, I got him out a bunch of times, but he got me a bunch of times. You know, I went back and looked at the stats on those games of all the clippings that my mother saved. And I think he batted probably 400 against me in low A ball. And
you know, not just you. I think he got most guys like that.
No, but the thing is they were all seeing eye singles. He made solid contact on ground balls and he hit them where they weren't. And it was, he just had this uncanny ability up the middle between short and the third. I mean, they just leaked through. And you're just like, damn. Double A, I had a better experience against him. But, you know, at 18 years old, he was already Don Mattingly. he already had that sort of legendary status that this guy, you know, is going to be somebody because of that swing. You know, speaking of Mattingly, he was probably the best two strike hitter I've ever seen. In fact, he would take two strikes. He would take a bunch of pitches just to sort of mess with the pitcher's mind because he was so confident he could make contact on just about anything, even out of the strike zone. You know, he could fight off quality pitches just to stay alive to finally get the pitch that he wants. And it seemed like he always got the pitch that he wants because he hit so many balls so hard. And I watched from the bench when we were teammates in AAA. For a couple seasons before he went up and did all that great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason the greats are great.
There's a reason the greats are great is because he always had a work ethic. I mean, he went to work every day and he worked on his swing every day, you know, and, you know, watching him take batting practice, it was different from other people. You know, there was a focus and a presence there that other people didn't have. Just the sound of the ball hitting his bat was different. You know, it was a louder, more solid crack than you've ever heard. So there was this bat speed that he brought to bear.
On the subject of work ethic, and mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned you were, you know, you got told you kind of got to get serious about your conditioning. What was the day-to-day work look like? What did the off-season work look like? Because in the era you pitched in the minor leagues, performance was still extremely important. Like, we'll get into it. You had incentives tied to wins and things like that. And there were a lot more emphasis on the team win and things like that. Whereas the minor leagues now is development over winning every single time. For instance, there's a previous guest from the show who in one GCL outing threw 60 pitches and the Pirates had him throw 58 fastballs because they needed him to work on fastball command. Where even out in Anderson, it seems like your number one job is to win and get outs. But if you're, say, toying with the slider or trying to incorporate something new, how do you balance, I'm trying to work on this thing, but my number one job is to win?
You work on it in the bullpen, in your bullpen session. You don't work on it out there in the game. You can't. You'll get killed. If you're thinking about mechanics out there or arm angle or grip, you're dead. It's just, you got to forget about all that, trust the work, and just be aggressive and go at the hitter and, you know, hook into your catcher, right? Yeah, so that first off season of mine, between my first and second season, I took a martial arts / conditioning class 3 nights a week with Gus Huffling. And Gus Huffling was Steve Carlton's personal trainer. He was a black belt in Kung Fu. He was some crazed ex-Green Beret with all these skills. And Carlton swore by him. And the stories were Carlton would, you know, had this strength in his fingertips to manipulate his sliders because he was driving his hand into a barrel full of rice and twisting his arm around and doing all kinds of exotic, you know, Chinese Shaolin temple routines with Gus Huffling. So I was in the best shape of my life with Gus Huffling that winter. I mean, the type of cardio he had us doing, I mean, God, I was 21 and I almost had a heart attack. So I went to spring training and just, you know, I was like Bjorn Borg level low heartbeats, you know, and per minute. And I was so confident in my ability. I felt invincible, and I knew I just knew I wasn't going to lose a single game that season because I was in such great shape.
Well, the kind of shape you had to be in back then in the minor league. So your first year in Anderson, freshly drafted. During 28 games, you threw 165 innings. Do you know where that would have placed you among the 2025 minor league baseball leaders?
Probably on way on top.
You would have led minor league baseball in innings.
Yeah.
You would have also
Nobody throws innings anymore.
Would have also led in shutouts. looking at like your workload and like running, you know, I was running through all the clips and stuff like that. Like some of it is just, it's unheard of, but there's one thing from your Anderson season that I want to touch on. Cause it's the most, like you're a professional baseball player, but this is the most minor league thing. I found this clip from the Anderson Independent, July 29th, 1980, headline, "Youngsters Put Braves Through a Workout." It's by staff writer Robert Bradley. And seemingly, you guys get back from a doubleheader in Asheville at 1 a.m., and you have to be at the field at 10 a.m. for a youth baseball clinic. And you're quoted in this. "The slider has never been one of my better pitches," Patterson said. "And I noticed this kid throwing an awesome slider. I pulled him over to the side and asked him how he was gripping the ball and hoping maybe I might pick up on something." Is that something you actually remember? Or is that, I got to give this guy a nice quote about how much I enjoyed doing this clinic?
I don't remember that, but I had a better curveball at that time. I kind of had a slurve. I didn't really have a true slider. And yeah, it was elusive. The slider for me was a little bit elusive. It was either really good or really not. And if you want to hear the slider story,
would love to.
You know, I didn't really have at times I had a big league slider, late breaking, hard down, nasty slider, you know, every couple of starts, maybe, right? It was inconsistent. So I'd lean on a curveball, which I was throwing better in the low minors than I could get away with it. But I think in double A and triple A in the major leagues, that curveball probably wasn't good enough as a swing and miss pitch. You know, it wasn't like a nasty knuckle curve. It wasn't nasty enough. So I knew I had to, I mean, it's something I could just plop in there to get ahead on the count, right? But it's not a kill pitch. It wasn't a kill pitch. Sometimes, but not consistently, right? And that's the key, consistency. So I didn't really have a breaking pitch that I could go to 3-1, 2-0, and I knew I could throw it for a strike or get an out, you know, like a 3-2, when you need to have it. I didn't have that in my arsenal. So I tried to develop a changeup, which I did. I developed a pretty good changeup, and I developed later in my career a forkball, which was very effective against nasty little left-handed leadoff hitters that like to punch the ball the other way and run out, you know, their ground ball. Now I could strike them out with a forkball or a split finger fastball. And it wasn't until I was with the Texas Rangers at Rule 5, they Rule 5 me, and they basically gave me the closer job to lose. And I went into camp, and this is a side story. I got very ill with an unknown virus 5 days before I was reported to camp. And I
saw that battling with Mitch, with Wild Thing Mitch Williams.
Yes. Yes. Mr. 300 walks and 160 inning guy. You know, Tom House, when I was well enough to compete, right, in spring training, it took a couple of weeks for me to get over this virus. And I'd lost weight and I'd lost my conditioning. So I came back slowly in camp. But Tom House started tinkering with my slider. And he showed me his version of a slider and he explained the logic of it. And by golly, there it was. All these years I'd been searching for it, and there it was.
By that point, it's 1986, and so you've by been that a professional point, yeah, for right, almost 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I was 6 years in. And here I am, and I still had a good fastball, a good changeup, and now Tom gave me this nasty slider. And it was simple. It was a simple grip. It was a simple release point. Everything was simple about it, and it worked. You know, it broke late and it broke hard, and there was no strain on my elbow at all. The skies opened up for me. I'm telling you, it changed everything. So the first hitter I face in post learning this slider is Andre Dawson. They came to our place. Montreal came to our place, and Don Slott was catching, and he called for a fastball in, and I threw it up and in, and Andre swung so hard that I called Don out and said, "No more fastballs, please. No more. No, no, no." I'd never seen a human being get a bat through the strike zone that fast, and it actually scared me.
I believe he was one of the guys who would break a bat on a swing, like over his back. I think he was in like the Jim Rice category.
It was just crazy. I just was like, that didn't just happen. So then I said, just nothing but sliders from now on. Second pitch, I threw a slider right at the knees on the outside black. He swung and missed. Third slide, 0-2 pitch was a slider 6 inches outside at the knees. He swung and missed, sat him down. Next two pitches, got two outs. That was it. Five pitch save. And I went into the dugout and I looked at Tom House and I just said, thank you very much. And he just has his smile on his face like, you know, keep it up.
That's why he's Tom House. That's why spent the next 30 years doing that with pitchers. We're gonna come back to that spring training with the Rangers, but go from one Hall of Famer in Andre Dawson to another. Your second full season, you're ticketed for Durham. Walk me through the conversation you had with Hank Aaron before that season about your contract. This is one I know you've told before, but I have to hear it.
Hank was just a really good guy. You know, he was unassuming and a very mild, very kind person. and really carried, you know, he carried himself like the legend that he is. But he never put on airs or anything. He was just a nice, nice fella. And I went into his office. I asked for a meeting and he granted it. And I said, listen, I want to make you a deal. I want $900 a month. They'd offer $725. I'd sign the contract. I was making $600 before taxes at Anderson. They bumped me up to $725 a month for 4.5 months. There's no money in minor league baseball at that time. I said, I want $900 a month. He says, why should I pay you more than everybody on the team? And I said, because I'm not going to lose a game. And I promise that I won't lose a game. In fact, if I do lose a game, I'll pitch for free the entire season. How's that? And he just looked at me like, and he smiled. And he said, you're that confident that you, he says, you know, baseball's a tricky game. You can throw the best game of your life and still lose it. I said, I'm not going to lose a game, Mr. Aaron. And if you pay me more than everybody, it'll be a sign that this, or to me, it'll trigger something psychologically that I am valued above and beyond everybody, and I will perform at that level. I need that from the organization. So he agreed, and I didn't lose a game.
Yeah, you go to Durham and you shove. Sunday, May 15th, 1981, John Roth, I have to credit, wrote a bunch of really excellent stuff that summer covering you. But this one is about a game your team lost, but you went 10 in the third innings. You threw 150 pitches.
Yep.
And this quote I really liked is from you. But you've got to love the way this team pulls together, Patterson said. We don't get blown out or walked over. Nobody's going to do that to us. Right now, there's a million guys in this clubhouse that are thinking they blew the game. There were that many opportunities. All this does is pull us together more. I guarantee you we will blow Peninsula off the field this weekend. Unity, that's what it's all about. And that quote was fascinating to me because touching on, you know, you told Hank Aaron, you're not going to lose the game, you're going to win. It conveys this attitude of these guys are here to win. It's not, you know, I'm worried about my development. I'm trying to get to the big leagues, things like that. And I'm just curious what clubhouse chemistry was like back then in terms of, you know, you're going to a series. Are you guys fighting tooth and nail to win? Like what's the priority there team wise? Or was it still everyone's kind of, okay, I want to get moved up. I'm trying to get to the big leagues. I'm trying to focus on me because quotes like that and being willing to go 10 and a third innings tells me that like, hey, we want to come away with the win here. That's an important thing.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the guy that posed me left-hander also went 10 plus innings. I think he pitched a better game than I did. He was great that night. But listen, if we're talking about Durham, we're talking about Dirty Al Gallagher as a manager who rejected me in 1980, told me I didn't look like I was trying hard enough out there, and he's not taking me to Durham. And you got to bust your ass a little more, Patterson, because I used to have a very lackadaisical, very easy, very fluid windup, and then the ball would explode out of my hand, and that's what I liked. And I thought that kind of lulled hitters to sleep. But you know, now I had to start busting my butt to make Al Gallagher's high A Carolina League team, which is what I did over the winter. So I came in with the Hank Aaron deal, with trying to impress Dirty Al Gallagher. And then there's Bob Veal, 6'6" of Alabama badass. And he pretty much tore down the old pitcher and built a new one. He turned me into a winning machine, just mentally. So that's when I became a professional, when every single time out I had the same mentality, and that was to attack and win and not be very nice about it either. And I really sort of, you know, I drifted toward that old school mentality of brushback pitches and even, you know, putting one in somebody's ear if they got a little cocky up there. And, you know, Veal would tell me, you know, you're the pitcher. The pitcher controls the defense. You control the ball. You set the tempo out there, not the hitter. If the hitter makes you wait, knock him down. If he makes you wait again, put one in his ear, this kind of thing. Let him know who's running the show out there. Like, just take responsibility, son. and win. Just take the responsibility, be a professional and take the responsibility. So I wanted to impress him as well. And in our running drills, I never doubled over because I wanted to impress him that I had enough wind to deal with what he was doling out to us. So it was just like tough guy stuff. Like I'm tougher than everybody and I can go more innings and I can throw more pitches. And I ended up, you know, practically leading the league in every category. I think Mike Brown and I were neck and neck. He was with Winston-Salem and he was having a very strong season as well. Yeah, that was Bob Veal, Dirty Al Gallagher. These were tough guys. And Sonny Jackson was a tough guy. I mean, they're not messing around, man. You become a pro or get out, you know, they weren't having it. And then you've got Johnny Sain visiting everyone. So, I mean, it's kind of I look back on my career and it's just sort of like I was exposed to the finest baseball minds of that time. Feel very lucky in that regard. But yeah, so Durham was my proving ground my coming out party where I was declaring I am a professional now. I know how to win and I'm coming. I'm a prospect.
You have this great season in Durham. You make it to Savannah. You pitch well in Savannah. The AJC is writing you up. You're kind of in this now cream of crop of Braves pitching prospects that are coming.
Right.
A couple starts into your first AAA season in 1982, you're dealt.
Right.
Curious the general, the change in logistics, change in organization, who you're now learning under, things like that. And then the emotional weight of I built up this credibility, you know, I was able to walk into Hank Aaron's office and do this deal last year. And now I'm in a completely new organization, fairly intimidating organization, intimidating man up top. Like curious what that does to a guy who's still, you know, 23, 24 years old, and trying to make it to the majors.
I think I was 22 or 23 at that time. Yeah. Made the Richmond team out of spring training by dominating New York Yankees AAA teams, dominating them. And Eddie Haas, who was the toughest screw I ever played for, and Johnny Sain was a pitching coach at Richmond, supported me, liked me. And he took me to AAA with him. And I won my first game in Toledo, went 7 1/3. Sammy Ellis was sitting in the stands, Yankees AAA coach. He'd driven up from Columbus. I kind of knew what was going on in the offseason because the Yankees tried to get me for Bobby Brown, or the Braves tried to deal me for Bobby Brown, and Steinbrenner put the kibosh on that deal. So I knew something was afoot. I didn't know whether it was over, but whatever. Second start was in Charleston, and I threw like four shutout innings, and then it started to rain and I gave up three innings and got taken out and kind of whined about it in the paper. And Eddie Haas just lit me up, man. He goes, Patterson, goddamn excuses. I don't hear that shit no more. Goddamn you lost the game because you lost the game. You threw like crap in the fifth inning. That's why you lost the game. I don't hear no fucking excuses ever again. You got that boy, you know, this kind of thing. Then he'd spit. I got to tell you, I love that man. I loved that guy. They had some very impressive people in that organization who really knew their baseball, but it was just a mentality, you know. Get the word that I'm traded, you know, Eddie tells me in his office, our first homestand opening 82 season in Richmond. He calls me in during batting practice, said, you got traded to the Yankees. I just threw my head back and said, oh no, I used an expletive. Everybody in the minor leagues and in the major leagues knew that the New York Yankees was not the place you wanted to be in the early 80s. No matter if it was the big league level or at the minor league level, that is not you especially didn't want to enter at the minor league level, because the chances of getting to the big leagues with the Yankees from the minor leagues in the early 80s was nil. It wasn't going to happen. I mean, Willie McGee wasn't even considered good enough, and he got to St. Louis in 82 and led him to the World Series and got MVP, right? But he wasn't good enough to even play AAA with the Yankees. So I just remember packing my stuff, saying my goodbyes, sitting beyond the outfield bullpen at a picnic table and just staring before I did getting in my car and driving to Columbus that night. I was devastated. It hurt. I was leaving, 2 years of friends, and I loved the organization, and I thought in a matter of weeks I was going to be in Atlanta because I was throwing the ball so well. I knew I was going to be in Atlanta by halfway through the season. And here I am going to this new place that I didn't want to go to. And once I got there, I knew I didn't want to be there. I didn't like their stadium. It was AstroTurf and steel and concrete and impersonal and nothing natural about it. And I was, 5, 6, 7 years. I was the youngest guy there by 5 or 6 or 7 years. Guys were smoking cigarettes in the clubhouse. Their children were running around. It was like a big league atmosphere, but it was in the minor leagues. It just was the wrong culture for me. I showed up in ripped jeans and cowboy boots and a Philadelphia Flyers jersey and long hair. And Frank Verde, the manager of the Columbus Clippers, just said to me, "Son, you're just going to need to cut your hair and get a new wardrobe. And you're a Yankee now. And you got to." And I'm just like, "Oh, shit."
Yeah, no facial hair either. Mustache only?
No. Back then, it was no facial hair, no long hair. Everything had to be short and collars and suits on the planes and the whole thing. I mean, it was just dreadful. And I knew I wasn't going to fit in. And it's not that I fought it. It was just like the culture there was one of fear. It was a fear club. I found that people were terrified of Steinbrenner. It was just such a toxic atmosphere for me. It was suffocating for me. I didn't like pitching off of that mound. I didn't like the stadium. Love the fans. They were very supportive. And I would have been fine pitching in AAA with Richmond, because I felt supported and I felt like I had a family. I did not fare that well in Columbus because I was living way outside of town with no teammates, but with some executive from the Clipper organization in his house. He was nice enough to let me live in his house because I, came in 9 days into the season. So everybody'd paired up or whatever. I just felt like I was alone all the time. I drove way, half an hour, 45 minutes out to the house after every game and nobody was home. I was just alone all the time. There weren't really very many. I don't know that I was accepted the way I could have been, I just felt like I said, it was a lonely experience.
When you talked about the bonds you've had with some of the Braves coaching staff and the people who took you under your wing and stuff like that, mm-hmm. when you get to this new organization, is there anyone who tries to put their mark on you? Hey, we brought in this new prospect. We want you to try this, or we want you to do this, or we envision you in this way, or was it just get out there and throw, Bubba?
Sammy Ellis right away wanted to turn me, he said, "You can throw 95. If you can throw 95 without using your legs, you can throw 100 if we turn you into a drop and drive guy." And I was still at that time very thin and long. And I just, you know, I could throw a ball very hard. At that time, I threw harder than just about anybody. 95, 94, 95 was really the top end for pitchers at that time, right? Except Nolan Ryan, maybe, and a few other guys, J.R. Richard, a couple other guys, but not very many people threw in the mid 90s. But they thought I had greater potential than that. And, you know, despite his best efforts, Sammy, and despite his belief in my ability to do that, it just didn't work. And I could never consistently apply what he was teaching me. And I was out there all the time thinking about mechanics instead of aggressively trying to get the hitter out.
Exactly what you said earlier. You can't be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was my undoing. But the thing is they see something I didn't, and I couldn't make the adjustment. Whose fault is that? You know, if you want to play the blame game, you can do that. But it's like, at the end of the day, I couldn't make the adjustment. And these are people that have a lot of experience, and they have a tremendous amount of knowledge. I mean, Sammy Ellis was a great pitching coach, and he helped out a lot of guys. It just didn't work for me, you know, for some reason. You know, so I was hot and cold that year, and it was probably my best as a starter. It was my best AAA season compared to my other AAA seasons, which were half seasons.
Yeah.
Where well, my ER.
I wanted to talk about that because you pitch a full season at AAA and then you get ticketed for AA the next year. Just what does that do to your psyche when, you know, a year prior you had nothing but upwards momentum, you know, going to be in Atlanta by midseason, and then suddenly they're sending you back to a level that you've already dominated at?
Well, yeah, going to Nashville was cool because it was Nashville, but it was AA, and I was back in the Southern League, 2 years later, right? It's 83 now, and here I am. I'm 24 now and I'm in AA, and I just, that didn't sit well with me. So, I started off, I think I pitched a really bad game. Then I pitched a really good game, and then a bad game, and then a good game. So I was 2-2 with about a 6 or a 7 ERA. For some reason they bring me up to, pitch to start in the Mayor's Cup game in New York. Sammy meets me in the clubhouse before we get on the bus to go over to Shea. Hey, you got 6 innings in you? And I'm, sure. Yeah. Great. And then Ben Callahan walks into the door from Columbus. And Sammy says, hey, Ben, you got 6 in you today? Yeah, great. Yeah. So I end up in the dugout. Ben starts. Sammy comes to me in the dugout. And he says, Billy wants to know what you're doing in the dugout. I said, I'm not pitching. What do you want me to do? Where do you want me to go? He goes, the bullpen. I said, all right. So I ran out to the bullpen. So I warmed up in the 7th, 8th, and 9th and never got in. Went back to Nashville the next day. The press asked me what happened. I said, I have no idea what happened. It was, I don't have no idea why they did this. I missed a start.
I went and found the box for that game because when I found a clipping that you had been sent for the Mayor's Trophy game, I was like, oh, this will be a cool thing to talk about. And then I found the box for the game, and I was like, why would they send him up there?
Right. They were really good at pulling the rug out from under me. They did this, and then they did it again because after that experience, I went on to lead the league. I ended up, you know, 6-2 with about a 1.5. So combined 8-4 with a 2.75 halfway, made the all-star team, was the leading pitcher in the league in a couple categories. And Doug Holmquist comes to me and says, New York called, you're going up tomorrow. And just make sure when Billy comes out to the mound to take the ball away from you, don't argue with him the way you do me. Just give him the ball and trot off. So I call my family. I call my friends. Next day comes. I dress out Nashville, go out in batting practice. Holmquist calls me in. Everybody's hooting, hollering, oh, big leaguer, you know, this kind of thing. And I'm just floating on air, right? I'm going to the Yankee Stadium. I'm going to wear the pinstripes. Get in the office. It's a tiny office. There's Doug Holmquist. There's Hoyt Wilhelm, who, by the way, Hoyt Wilhelm turned me into a real pitcher. With Hoyt, I had control of my fastball. I had a changeup that I could throw at any time. I had a nifty little slider. Well, not a great one, but pretty nifty. I'd get away with it. And I had a couple of different types of sinking fastballs and rising fastballs and some off-speed stuff. So I was really a pitcher then. You know, I was locating. I was setting hitters up. He was a great, great mentor. He was a great pitching coach. So I was ready. I was ready to go up there and compete at the big league level. And Holmquist says, I got good news and bad news. What do you want to hear first? And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, it's all good news because it sounds to me like I've been traded to Cleveland or Pittsburgh and I'm going to go to the big leagues and yay, I'm out of here. You know, because in 83, I went to spring training with the Yankees and what a circus that was. Okay. I mean, we could do a whole podcast based on that experience. But anyway, they said, well, you're going up. And I said, yeah. And he goes, but you're going to Columbus. And I just sort of, you know, took that shot. And I said, nah, I don't want to go. I said, why don't you just tell him I want to stay here? I'm going to stay here. I don't want to go. I like it here. I don't want to go to AstroTurf and concrete and steel and Triple A Yankee BS. I want to stay here. I like it here. I'm winning here. Why don't I just win 20 games here and they could trade me? And I don't give a crap anymore. What I mean, and they said, well, we can't do that. You have to go. So I think I had an agent at the time. I called him and I said, I just can't do this anymore with this organization. You know, this is a second rug pull in the space of 2 months. I'm going to pitch the Mariners Cup game. I don't get in. I'm going to the big leagues. They send me to AAA. I said, what is going on? This is too schizophrenic for words. Now they're just messing with me, you know? So now I'm embarrassed. I call my family. I call my friends. I'm not going up. I'm sorry. They're sending me to AAA. So I go to AAA and I try to keep a good, you know, mentality. I win the first game. I take a 2-3 hitter into the ninth. I gave up a home run in the ninth and I ended up giving up 2 runs in 8 2/3. Next start, I think I win. I'm thinking, okay, now they're going to call me up. And they just didn't. And I forget who the manager was at that time. 83. Maybe it was Johnny Oates. I went into Johnny Oates and I said, listen, what's going on here? You know, I told him about what happened. He knew. I said, now I'm like 2-0 here. What's going on? He said, Scotty, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. You deserve to go up. He said, but the reality is you're here and let's just focus on winning here. I said, okay. And I just couldn't. I felt betrayed and I didn't trust the organization anymore. And I really wanted out. I really wanted out. I was as angry as I have ever been to be treated that way. It was just such a slap in the face. And it's not like they were doing anything in New York. You know, I think they were struggling to stay in fourth or fifth place in the division. So, and I'd look at the box scores every day and say, oh, well, you know, they need starting pitching. So anyway,
well, in the next few years, they have you doing the same thing, the yeah. double, the triple A yeah. shuttle. How do you go about working on your craft or staying motivated when that call can't come?
I was no longer motivated to work on my craft. I was motivated to get out of there. and I did not handle it the right way, you know. But how are you supposed to act when you know you've given your best, and it's completely ignored? In fact, they took me off the 40-man roster after the 83 season on my 25th birthday, by the way. I got the registered letter. You know, Murray Cook was the GM at the time and said, I'm sure you feel you've made some progress, you know.
So they send you a letter. They don't call you to let you know, like, or they don't call you, your agent, anyone to be like, hey, we're going to take you out the 40 man.
They didn't give a damn. And I was, I guess at that point, and I knew it, they no longer considered me somebody that they wanted in New York, no matter what I did. And then I started the 84 season in Columbus as a starter. It didn't go well. And they sent me to Double A, and it didn't go well. I didn't pitch very well at all in 84. 85, they converted me to a short reliever, and I went to Double A and dominated the league. And, you know, I had like a 1.2 ERA. And then they bring me back up to Triple A, and it's probably the best I've ever pitched in Triple A, right? I pitched to like a 3-2 or something like that, in a sort of a short and really kind of a, not a long reliever, but a medium to short reliever. So I was pitching three innings at a time. Sometimes I'd be in a save situation in the ninth. Sometimes I'd come in the sixth.
Did you like the bullpen? Cause sometimes some guys take to that. They like being as soon as you get out there.
I wanted to be the ninth inning guy, but in Double A, I shared those duties with Randy Graham, who had a nice sinker, a nice slider. So we shared those duties. So we were pretty much an unhittable duo in Double A. And then Triple A, you know, I did not have the ninth inning job solely. Once in a while, I think they brought Kurt Brown in. I think Kurt Kaufman was pretty much our ninth inning guy in 85. If I'm not mistaken, maybe he was out of the organization by then, but Kurt Kaufman had one of those early 80s seasons to the mid 80s. He just dominated the league as a ninth inning guy because he had that nice slider.
Did you keep the same repertoire when you moved to the bullpen? Cause often like starter, you got to mix it up, especially if you're throwing 10 innings, you got to have something new for the third or fourth time around the order. Did you fall into, I've got these two strengths and I hammer it? Or did you say, I'm going to pitch with the same, you know, the same array of pitches I have as a starter, I'm just going to bring that to the bullpen?
I pretty much threw fastballs. I just came at them. You know, in Double A, it was more of a ninth inning guy, sometimes eighth inning. So I was just gassing everybody up. And in Double A, they couldn't catch up. In Triple A, it was pretty much the same, but I mixed in more of a slider. I had a pretty good slider, 85 in Triple A. And Sammy Ellis was back there, and he kept assuring me, you're doing great. You're going up. You know, they're going to call you up in September, even though you're not on the roster, man. You're throwing great. And then September came, and I didn't get called up. And I just sort of remember staring into my locker like, what am I doing here? You know, I'm just getting old, you know, and I don't need to be here anymore. So Texas Rule 5.
Yeah. Were you familiar with the Rule 5 draft?
I was. My agent at the time was Dennis Gilbert, Beverly Hills Sports Council. I'd played in Puerto Rico and Dominican, and I met a fella, a teammate who turned me on to Dennis. He was represented by Dennis. So now I was out in California in the winter, staying in shape, the good weather. And, you know, Dennis was a great advocate. He went to the winter meetings that year, talked the Texas Rangers into taking me Rule 5. And I think I was the first pitcher taken in that Rule 5 thing. That was the Bobby Bonilla Rule 5 too. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
Bonilla
it was.
Jeff Parrott was in that. He was a teammate at Texas. You know, some good players were in that. Yeah, that was a big day when Texas called. I was in Dennis's office that next morning, and they said, we took your boy. He's going to be our ninth inning guy. And we just like jumped up and hugged each other. You know,
what was every outing that spring like? because you're in this everything compared to just a normal minor league season like this. You're competing with Mitch Williams. It looked a young team. It seems like you've got Bobby Witt Sr. out there. Steve Buschel, son played it here in Texas. Young roster. Like what were the nerves like for every outing when every outing is seemingly a tryout?
Well, I was battling a health issue and I was trying to come back from that virus, right? So they had, for the first couple of weeks of spring training, they had a very young crop of pitchers, Edwin Correa, Edwin Nunez, Bobby Witt, and Mitch, right? And other young, they're 20, 21-year-old guys. And they all had great arms. I mean, really impressive arms. Mitch Williams had a very impressive from the left side. He had an explosive fastball with movement. He just didn't know where it was going. He had no idea where it was going. But I remember we were playing Kansas City and Mitch hit George Brett in the back. And George Brett ran by our dugout, really cracked us all up. And he looked at Valentine as he was running to first base. He goes, "Do not take that son of a bitch to the big leagues." And that's exactly why they did. Because if George Brett gets intimidated, you've got something, right? So they did. They just decided to take him. I gave them an excuse not to take me because I, by the way, after the Andre Dawson 5-pitch save that morning, they took me to the Yankee game that night. We got on a bus and headed over to Lauderdale, and Bobby Valentine said, "You want to go face your old teammates maybe tonight?" I said, "Hell yeah, I do." So the story of that is I hadn't had anything to eat since breakfast and I couldn't find anything to eat in the clubhouse. And there wasn't even a clubhouse for us. And I was trying to get hot dogs from the hot dog vendors just to get something to eat. And I did get in the game at 10 o'clock at night on an empty stomach. And the first guy I faced, and it wasn't a safe situation. We were behind a couple runs. First hitter I faced was Dave Winfield.
not a great guy to face on an empty stomach. Not a great guy to face on a full stomach.
Really, really. And I go 0-2 on him with fastballs. And then, 10 pitches later, he worked the count full. And I'm pumping fastballs and he's fouling everything back. Straight back. He's just tipping it. And I'm just everything I got on every pitch and all fastballs. I didn't throw anything. I said, I'm going to show this guy up to Steinbrenner, who was here watching. I'm going to strike out your big salary guy on fastballs. That's the kind of ego I had. And so he worked me to a full count. I'm 10 pitches in. I throw a slider. I miss by a foot and ball four. And then, I ended up giving up a run and a hit and, it didn't go well. So I gave Texas the excuse to not take me in favor of Mitch Williams. I gave them a couple of bad outings as I was recuperating, but I also gave them some good outings where everything was, working very, very well.
Presumably you had to hope that the Yankees wouldn't take you back because they had to offer you back to the Yankees. I assume you were just hoping that you could go to AAA for Texas.
Texas sold me back. And I ended up back in, where did I go? I went to AAA. I was back in AAA.
Back in AAA. Back in, and then, doing the Columbus, then the Albany, doing the Columbus Albany shuffle.
Yep.
You finally get to free agency. You sign with the Dodgers. Spring training with the Dodgers. The parallels of talking to Hall of Famers. Walk me through the conversation with Sandy Koufax that
oh.
proved to be the end.
Well, I'd gone to Dominican for the Dodgers and pitched pretty well. And then I was in LA, so I came to Dodger Stadium every day to work out. So they were pretty familiar with me. I think I even throw a no-hitter in against a college team in Dodger Stadium. But I was having success before spring training. Go to spring training, and you know, it was Tim Cruz and I, and with non-roster guys invited to camp. One other guy, two other guys maybe. And we did not dress in the big league spring training clubhouse. They had us dress in the minor league clubhouse. We were the only four guys in that giant minor league clubhouse, which is right down the hall from the big. So we weren't allowed to mingle with the big league guys. So that was a bit of a turnoff, to be honest with you. I didn't really get a chance to pitch in any A games. I got into a few B games. I was working hard on the VersaClimber. Then the trainer said, "You can't work on the VersaClimber anymore. This is just for the big league guys." And I just sort of like, my attitude at that point was like, you know, wow. I was running my line in the running drills. I was, you know, beating 18-year-old kids, and you know, I was really trying to make a good impression. They just, I don't know, just didn't work out, right? I wasn't their guy. It was the same vibe as the Yankees organization, where it was all about this Dodger blue and bleeding Dodger blue and blah 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 blah. I don't buy into that kind of stuff. You know, it's like, I want to be on a team full of pirates or outlaws and, you know, go do damage. And then after the games, right, after we slaughter the men, we'll go to the bars. You know, I just that's kind of how I approach things. And the Yankees and the Dodgers were not those kind of organizations at all. They frowned upon that kind of behavior. So if it wasn't fun for me, if it was too serious, it wasn't really worth doing. It was kind of a drag. And the thing about the Yankees and the Dodgers is they always made you feel like you weren't good enough. And the thing about the Braves was, you know, you felt the opposite. And that's what I missed. I even wrote Hank Aaron a letter saying, "What do you think about trading for me? I want to come home." You know what I mean? And he wrote a very nice letter back. So that was my experience. And then they released me with like 3 days to go in spring training. Dennis said, drive over to Sarasota. And the White Sox are going to take a look at you. And I pitched two really strong innings for the White Sox, and Sammy Ellis was over there then as their pitching coach. And after I showered, and Sammy said, "Come up to Al Golden's office." He was the head of player development or whatever. Al started yelling at me. He said, "What the hell are you doing sitting in my office begging for a job with an arm like that? You should be making $1 million a year. What the hell is going on?" And I just looked at Sammy like, "What is happening here?" He said, "Son, we tried to get you 10 times over the last 4 years. You were untouchable. The Yankees would not trade you." I said, "Is that right?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "You are our number one guy that we tried to get and we couldn't get." And it all just washed over me at that point. And then he said, "I cannot tell one of these guys who've been busting their butts in this organization that they're not going to Hawaii right now." I cannot give you a triple A job. I cannot do it. And I know you're not going to want to go back to double A. And I said, you are right about that. And so that was that. That was my last hurrah. Now, prior to that, you know, Sandy and I connected. He saw that I was being rebuffed at every turn by the organization. And so he sat down with me at lunch one day, and we just sort of, I told him, you know, I idolized you growing up. My mother idolized you. And then we just sort of struck up this fast friendship, and we'd take walks after workout every day on the field. And he'd ask me about myself and what my dreams were and what I wanted to do. And, you know, he's the guy that pretty much said, it's time to go. It's time to get out. Raise your head up high with dignity and walk away. Because he could tell that I had a broken heart and that I needed to get away from the game, that it wasn't feeding me. And I certainly wasn't feeding it. So, you know, after the Chicago experience, I was just like, I got some offers to play in double A. Houston made an offer, and I just like, I'm done. I told Dennis, I'm done. I can't anymore. I can't ride buses anymore. I'm 20. What was it? 26, 27 at that time. I said,
you
I've given
played
baseball
86
enough
at 27.
I've given baseball my best years, and I'm going to move on now, you know? So
baseball done, but 7 years or so after you throw your last pitch, you make it to the big leagues at, you know, 10 years after that rug pull by the Yankees. I know there were guys in the cast that had been big leaguers, that, you know, currently in former, but curious, like, what were the emotions for you suiting up again, throwing again, working in my beloved Metrodome?
The, you know, that audition process was yet again another rug pull, because my manager sent me in to see the casting director, said, I've got your lead. Okay. I've got your lead. And I went in and read for them, and they called Andy Scheinman and said, we've got your lead. We found him. And they didn't tell him that I was a former baseball player. He said, but we have your lead in your film. So it was going to be me and Celia Ward. And we were very excited. And then there was a baseball tryout, and that's when they realized, like, what's up with you? Because you're like way better than everybody. Like, what's happening? And then I told them, and they go, oh, okay. Cause I was hitting, I was pitching, I was running the bases, I was playing the infield, I was playing the outfield, all the stuff. And I, you know, as a ball player, I could play any position well. I could catch, I could, you know, I love the game. I love the game. I love playing the game. I always did. It was just the politics and the types of organizations were my downfall. But the game itself, like, nothing gave me greater joy to play that game.
I always say in sports movies, you can tell, sports movies are just a passion of mine. And, right. you can tell when an actor was an athlete, or when you have an athlete actor, there are things that athletes do and ways they approach the game and ways that kind of come through on camera that you just can't really teach unless you've been there.
Nope.
And that's why, to me, that's why Little Big League is so good, because so many guys who were around the game were in that movie.
Yeah. So then I was informed, that I would not be the lead, that I would be, then they offered McGreevy, the disgruntled prima donna guy.
With great hair.
Right. It was the hair that put me over the top. Yeah. Right. When I had hair. And, so, I mean, what are you going to do? It's a big movie. We accepted, we were not happy, but, you know, rug pull, you know, of all people, Timothy Busfield at 5'7" and skinny legs was going to be the power hitting first baseman. And
yes,
I think what they understand in movies is you know, they're going to put a great actor there who we can sort of cut around and make you believe he's a great ball player. Seal Award dropped out. Ashley Crow came in, and it's interesting that her son is now an all-star.
PCA.
PCA, right? Ashley Crow's
in baseball.
Isn't that great? That's
I mean,
so
he's surely the real life Billy Haywood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you know, now he just has to take over the team. But yeah, that was fun. I mean, being around all those guys and, you know, Major League All, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. was there and Mickey Tettleton and all kinds of guys were coming in to shoot.
Yeah. I mean, the cameo lineup is unbelievable. Baerga and Sandy Alomar. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. That was fun. And I still could pitch then. You know, I was, 34, 35? And I still had some pretty good gas and pretty good hook and, you know, showed it off. And
like I said from the top, it's how I initially discovered that you had played in the big league or played professional baseball, because I was like, this guy looks like he's throwing fuzz. I will say, I don't know how often you rewatch your old stuff, but Little Big League holds up. I always say that, like, if Little Big League had been about the Cubs and Rookie of the Year had been about the Twins, people would be talking about Little Big League and not Rookie of the Year all the time. But genuinely huge fan.
Look, Little Big League was a much better movie before they really altered the script. The version I read and wanted to be in was much edgier and much funnier and much more real, because Billy Hayward was rebellious and cool and sophisticated and then they turned him into a real mama's boy. And indeed. Somebody
so,
who
so much so that he benches his star player for dating his mom.
Right. And it just, the edges were taken out of that script. And I just never understood why. And there was a couple of logic things for me that I didn't necessarily butt heads with the producers, but I said to Andy Scheinman, I said, why am I not starting the final game? I mean, the arc is Malcontent, who comes around, learns his lesson, and the audience has made an investment in this character. They see its full arc. Now it's not complete. You start some left-handed pitch who nobody – he's an extra.
Yeah, because in Major League, they start Harris and bring Vaughn in. There's that natural, you know. That,
right.
Yeah, it would have made much more sense if McGreevy is starting the final game.
I said, give me my moment. I mean, you know, I'm this like a-hole throughout the whole movie, and I'm reformed. I'm a team guy. Give me my moment. Let it be completed. And they just didn't see it that way. And I just thought it was silly. You know, I thought that movie, they left a lot on the table with that movie, and it was released between The Lion King and Forrest Gump.
That's a tough box office stretch right there.
Yeah, that means the studio had no confidence in it. That was just a throwaway. But that original script was really terrific. If they had shot that, then I think maybe we had a better chance, you know, doing Little Big League 2 or a bigger, little Big League or something.
Well, it was in that stretch of 90s movies where they made sports movies, but about pro sports with starring kids. And I promise you, it is still one of the best ones. Like, it's highly underrated.
No, I know people. I know people enjoy it, but I got to tell you, it was a much better film before they hacked the script up. It was a much better film. It was a great read. It was a really great read.
I think it might be up to you to remake it then. It's been enough time. The last thing I've got for you is if I couldn't
throw a baseball 60 feet right now.
You could be the man. You could be a Farinas character. You could be the manager who gets a can
yes,
in the beginning.
Yes, I could.
But if you could go back and give a pep talk to your 20-year-old self, the day you signed with the Braves, what would that pep talk look like?
There's nothing I could have told my 20-year-old self. I was the person I was because of the circumstances I grew up in. So there's not a thing I could say to. You know what I would have said to him? I would have told him that I loved him. As corny as that sounds, I would have said, I love you and I believe in you. That's what I would have said to him. And you can lean on me. That's what I would have said to him.
That's like the best answer I've ever had for that question. That is good stuff. Scott, tell the folk where can people get Scotty P's Big Mug Coffee?
Well, they can. There's no website anymore, and they can only buy it on a wholesale basis in bulk. But if you email support@scottyp.com, someone will get back to you and they'll take your 32 bag minimum order. Or if they want to do real Scotty P's Big Mug Coffee, we have a co-branding deal with Warner Brothers. And so all the Luke's Diner coffees and the Dragonfly Inn coffees and the, the Stars Hollow blends. And we've got a candy cane blend. We've got all kinds. So go to the WB Tours website. And you can, we have 33 SKUs of breakfast products with them, honeys, jams, and jellies, pancake mix, and all kinds of stuff. Coffee's hot chocolate. You name it, we got it. So go to WB Tours website and they you can get your Gilmore products. And that's all Scotty P's coffee. It's Scotty P's hot chocolate. It's hot Scotty P's jellies, jams, and baking mixes, and pancake mixes, and syrups, and maple syrups, and it's just a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing.
Well, as someone whose wife has a Luke's Diner clock in her office and was drinking her coffee from a Gilmore Girls mug today, I might have to invest in some. But Scott, thank you so much for joining the show. Really enjoyed it. Really appreciate you coming on from Phenom to the Farm.
Kyle, it's a pleasure, and thanks for having me on.
Of course. And that's it for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm. A huge thanks to Scott Patterson for stopping by, walking us through his career. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We'll catch you in a month. Thanks for listening.